Coming up, a hospice chaplain helping dying patients find the meaning in their lives.
Is there a God? Is there a God who knows I'm sick? Is there a God who cares that I'm sick?
Also, one of the world's most admired Jewish rabbis and the project that took him 45 years to complete.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Religious groups held rallies and a 48-hour prayer vigil in front of the Supreme Court this week as the justices heard oral arguments over Arizona's controversial immigration law. At issue in the case is whether the state law infringes on the federal government's authority to establish and enforce immigration policy. But several faith groups argue the law violates the dignity of immigrants and could result in racial profiling. For more on this, I'm joined by Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, and Patricia Zaper, a staff writer with Catholic News Service, who's been covering the faith community and immigration. Pat, it's nice to have you back here again.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
The Catholic bishops and many other religious leaders want a whole new kind of approach to immigration. What specifically, what exactly do they want?
Well, that could take the whole program to explain. They want a comprehensive approach, something that gives people who are already here illegally the chance to legalize their status so that they can pull their families together, reunite torn apart families, work legally, be able to go home to their home countries and visit their families there. They want path for jobs. There's a whole assortment of things.
Mm-hmm. Any likelihood that they might get those things anytime soon?
I think that's probably very unlikely in an election year, although it might make for some good political demanding during this season.
One of the arguments this particular week as the case was at the court from the religious community was that some of the local laws could hinder their ministry. What were they talking about?
Well, this came up most conspicuously in 2006 in a version of legislation that passed the House, included a provision that would make it illegal for anybody to help people who are in the country illegally. Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles, then the Archbishop, at that time told his priests that if this bill passes, I'm not going to expect you to follow through with that, to follow that law. It's seen as an imposition on the rights of people of faith to take care of others.
People talk about the rights of other people too, and what do the religious leaders say to those who say, look, we've got laws and laws need to be enforced and obeyed?
Well, I think the religious leaders agree that states, government have a right to enforce their borders, but their arguments against the current immigration situation relate to the civil rights era when Dr. Martin Luther King and bishops and priests and rabbis were at the forefront of arguments that the laws requiring segregation were inhumane and they were unjust laws, that they had a right and an obligation to fight against those laws.
What are some of the theological and moral arguments that these religious leaders, really across a pretty broad spectrum, are making on this?
Well, and they go back to the Old Testament to call, and into the New Testament to calls to take care of the stranger, to take care of those people who have no rights in a society. They are throughout scriptures. That's one of the main things that they go to.
There was some new data that came out this past week about the number of immigrants from Mexico going down for the first time in a long time. Has that changed things at all?
Not really, because there are a lot of people who are in the country illegally to begin with, and that doesn't reflect a slowing of migration from Central America, from South America. Just because the situation in Mexico is changing doesn't really change the whole picture all that much.
Situation changing, what, better job opportunities?
In Mexico, yes. Mexico's economy has improved. There's a lower birth rate, an assortment of factors involved in that.
Yeah. Pat Zaper of Catholic News Service, many thanks.
Thank you.
Congressman Paul Ryan delivered a major speech on the budget this week amid protests from some Catholics who say he's misusing church teachings to support cutting government programs that help the poor. Speaking at Georgetown University on Thursday, Ryan said Catholic social teaching did guide his thinking on these issues and that federal programs aren't necessarily the best way to help the needy.
Simply put, I don't believe that the preferential option for the poor means a preferential option for big government.
But in a letter to Ryan, 90 Georgetown faculty and staff members argued his budget does not appear to reflect the values of the gospel.
This is not the time for the federal government to step aside and say, hey, you're on your own. No.
President Obama marked Holocaust Days of Remembrance with a visit to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Joined by survivor Elie Wiesel, the president spoke of the need to reject hatred in all forms. He said the U.S. has a moral responsibility to prevent genocide. He also announced the creation of a government-wide committee to help combat atrocities. Members of the United Methodist Church gathered in Florida this week for the denomination's general conference, held every 4 years. Delegates are once again debating several issues dealing with homosexuality, including the church's ban on non-celibate gay clergy and gay marriage. In recent years, there's been a steady growth in hospice care for the terminally ill. The idea is to ease the suffering of people in their last months of life. Comforting the dying is a natural calling for chaplains, and correspondent Bob Thaw visited a hospice chaplain in New Bedford, Massachusetts. She told him about the importance of listening carefully as dying patients search for the meaning of their lives.
If you'd like to know what a hospice chaplain does,
I'm freezing cold, huh?
Watch Carrie Egan in New Bedford, Massachusetts, as she visits 71-year-old Jim Burgo, who didn't want his face shown and who's dying from liver disease.
I don't want to suffer. I know I'm going to die, but I don't want to suffer.
At life's end, when Burgo is anguished and needs to talk about dying, the hospice chaplain listens and comforts.
A lot of things about Vietnam I'm not proud of either.
Mm-hmm. And I think God forgives those things.
I hope so. I really hope so.
If one aspect of her healing ministry can be somber, her visit to the Fall River home of 97-year-old Mary LaBrie shows another.
When we all see Jesus, we'll sing and shout the victory.
Here, the mood is upbeat because Mary, unlike Jim Burgo, faces death with absolutely no fear, indeed looks forward to being in heaven and being reunited with her late husband of 75 years.
Oh, yeah, I'll see them again. So, but we'll all be together someday.
What will that be like when you're all together again?
Oh, that'll be wonderful.
Carrie Egan counsels people of all different faiths, and not all of her patients are religious. But the common thread in her work, she says, is helping people give meaning to their lives.
How do you make sense of all of this that's going on in your life? For every person that I go in to see, my goal is the same, which is to find out what their goal is and to help them meet it.
A chaplain for 13 years, Carrie Egan, says that what is crucial is learning how to listen.
I hear terrible stories sometimes, terrible stories. And the most compassionate thing you can do is not turn away. Oftentimes, for you to go in and say, it's okay, when they full well know it is not okay, it shuts them up. So now they can't say, I'm frightened, I'm angry, I'm confused, because now they need to act like everything is okay.
Listening is the most important thing?
Yes. Deeply listening to what it is they're saying.
Carrie says something was brewing with Jim Burgo. Finally, she understood. His father had taken him away from his mother when he was very young, and Burgo was afraid it was going to happen again.
So are you afraid that you'll die?
and you'll go to heaven. And your mother.
I'm not afraid
and,
of going to
no,
heaven.
No, but that your mother and your father will be there, and then your father will take your mother away again.
That is very, very possible in my mind, yeah.
Well, there's no point in sugarcoating it, right? That's not helpful. If someone is dying and they're sick, they know it.
Teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. Yeah. And lo, I am with you always.
Oh, that's my favorite verse.
I know it is.
Mm.
Some people really come to the end and they feel good. Though they've done a lifetime of work and of thinking about this, and they just want someone to be there with them to sort of to enforce those strengths they already have.
But others struggle, and Carrie Egan tries to see them come to terms with what ultimately matters.
For some people, there's an incredible relief to have someone come in and say, what did this all mean? What did my life mean? What does my death mean? Why am I sick? Is there a God? Is there a God who knows I'm sick? Is there a God who cares that I'm sick?
For a while, what Carrie couldn't understand was why her patients talked to a chaplain so much about their families.
It took me a long time to realize that that is how people are talking about God. Again, they might not use the term God, but that's how they talk about ultimate meaning. They're trying to get at love. They're trying to get at what God is. Jim is a great example of that. He was talking about his mother, and he was talking about love. What does the love of God look like? Am I going to get to see my mother again? Is the love my father showed me or didn't show me, is that what God is like?
Raised Catholic, now an Episcopalian, Carrie Egan isn't always successful. One patient actually threw a bedpan at her. But Jim Burgo's wife, Elaine, says that every time hospice chaplain Egan visits, Jim isn't the only one who benefits.
I'm going to check your blood for you.
She helps me by helping him. If I want to talk, I know she's there. And she's an excellent, excellent listener. We don't only discuss the Holy Spirit and God. I know she's there just knowing that he's going to die. If I want to discuss anything, she's available.
Just a few months ago, Mary was near death. Carrie and the hospice team brought her back to good health. And it was only with Carrie, says Mary's daughter Judy, that Mary was able to reveal how she worried about the grief her death would bring her children.
It gave me that peace, knowing that Mom, she's not in denial. She was just worried about us. She was worried about us children. That was really precious. You know, it's so good to have someone from outside the family that she can share with, so that she might say things to Carrie that she might not feel comfortable sharing with me as a daughter.
Family members, of course, are not the only ones who appreciate Carrie.
You make people better. You explain the God to me, and you've given me a whole bunch.
You read the Bible sometimes when it...
I read it every day.
Every day.
Yep.
Boy.
And there's some good information there to keep you going if you're concerned about things.
And yeah. Seeing Carrie, does that help you keep going, too?
Oh, yeah.
Carrie meets every day with members of the hospice team. This day, she talks with nurse Patty Martin about Mary's progress.
She's walking around. She's eating better. She's gaining weight.
Mary is doing so well, soon she'll have to be taken off hospice. That worries Carrie, because for patients, it's hard to lose the care they've come to depend upon. It's just another issue a hospice chaplain confronts.
Yeah.
What helps her cope and decompress, says Egan, is a happy home life. Two children, a supportive husband, two dogs. She prays, meditates, hikes, and dances. It helps, too, she concedes, to maintain a certain distance from her patients.
I have to remember that it's not about me, right? It's not personal. I'm a passing person in their life. You know, I'm not his wife. I'm not his daughter. I'm not his mother. I'm not even his best friend. You know, I'm his chaplain. And that's a very different role.
And when that distancing is not enough, Carrie says, she relies on her faith.
That gives me a lot of strength to do this, to be able to say that that this is not the end, and that life is hard, and really hard things happen, but that we can be with each other, we can help each other through it, and that's how God functions in this world.
With Jim Burgo or with Mary, Carrie Egan says she has learned that while there are miracles, her role is not to be a miracle worker.
It really is between the patient and God, right? And that the patient and God are going to do all the work. It's not like I have some magical presence in there. Not at all.
And what does Carrie get out of it?
I get enormous joy. People know so much more than they think they know when they're allowed to explore it themselves. And God is so much more present than anybody usually gives God credit for. And I get to see that. I get to know that.
Caring for them when their bodies are failing and their spiritual needs are crying out, too.
Such a good man.
I'm not, but someday.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
We're sorry to add that shortly after that interview, Jim Burgo died. We have a profile today of one of the world's most respected rabbis. He's a 74-year-old Israeli, Adin Steinsaltz, the author of 60 books on ethics, prayer, and mysticism, with a few mystery novels included. Rabbi Steinsaltz is most admired for a monumental project that took him 45 years, sometimes working 17-hour days. He translated the Babylonian Talmud from ancient Hebrew and Aramaic into modern Hebrew and added his own commentary and background. The Torah is Judaism's holiest text, Genesis through Deuteronomy. The Talmud is commentary on the Torah. But in its original languages, the Talmud was studied primarily by students and scholars. Now, the Steinsaltz Talmud will make it available to everyone. The holiest site in all Judaism is in Jerusalem, the western wall of the Second Temple, destroyed in the year 70. The devout come to the wall to pray, and so do many 13-year-old boys at the time of their bar mitzvahs, when they take on the full responsibilities of adults. One of those duties is studying the Torah with its 613 laws about how to live. The Torah, for Rabbi Steinsaltz, is a divine guide, a map of the paths and the main road through a world of danger and blessings. In his words, lions and angels.
We are living in the world. We really don't know what are the paths. We don't know what are the ways. We don't even know what the main road is. So we need some kinds of signs to tell us that is here live lions. And here possibly live angels. That's mostly what the Torah is as a book, basically. That's a book of instructions. Go this way, do it the other way. Do it, don't do it. So that's as simple as that.
Holy as the Torah is, its laws are in some ways unclear. For instance, it requires keeping the Sabbath, but it never explains exactly how. So the Talmud emerged, first as an oral tradition, later written down. Centuries of rabbinical commentaries interpreting the Torah's laws and arguing over them. Rabbi Steinsaltz began his translation of the Talmud when he was 28. It took him 45 years and ran to 45 volumes.
It was necessary because it's an important book. I once called it the center pillar of our culture.
Recently, Steinsaltz was in New York City teaching and explaining what's unique about the Steinsaltz Talmud, his own commentary and extensive background.
You have here the original Hebrew, the translation in English, and then you have, you see, notes about the law.
With his many books, as well as his Talmud translation, the rabbi personifies Judaism's commitment to learning and to argument as a means of understanding.
The idea of the Talmud is that you are allowed to ask questions about anything, everything, that can be done. Encouraging you to ask questions, trying to find answers.
And the rabbis let her then remarry.
Even though there was only one witness.
Even though there's only one witness.
Every day, students and scholars around the world study and question and debate the meanings of the Torah and Talmud and the arguments of rabbis who've studied them. There's no single authority to decide how best to interpret the religious law, but argument over the centuries can lead to general agreement until the next question and the next argument. Steinsaltz was raised in a secular Jewish family, but his father insisted he study the sacred texts so he would not grow up ignorant. I asked him how he became religious.
It was almost spontaneous. I didn't know where they came from. A belief in God is in a way the most natural, perhaps even the most primitive notion that people have.
But belief, said Steinsaltz, is just the beginning.
What is really difficult is not so much the belief, but the relationship. I'm still striving to become better, to become fit for serving him, to become a human being as he possibly wants me to be.
Steinsaltz sees all human beings as God's partners in what Jews call tikkun olam, repairing the world.
The Lord says, I made the world. It's pretty good. But there are all kinds of holes in it. You people go and you make the amendments, bigger ones, smaller ones, but you that's your duty.
The rabbi says even the smallest good deed can have a global result, the so-called butterfly effect.
The movement of the wings of a butterfly can change the world. And the point is, basically, we live in one world. Any movement in this world somehow affects everything else. So when we do anything better, we change the world.
If Jews study the Torah, if they honor the Sabbath and the other holy days, if they do good deeds and partner with God, Steinsaltz says they will achieve holiness. He also says everyone possesses a divine spark.
This spark is, in a way, trying to find its way to the main fire. And then it wants to sink into the main fire.
Steinsaltz said he saw no signs of any early peace in the Middle East, but he insisted that he had not despaired.
I am an optimist, meaning that I see things as black as they are, but there's still hope.
Talking with the rabbi, it was clear that his optimism rests on his absolute trust in God.
When you believe that, you see, everything comes from the Lord. So whenever something happens, if it's a glad thing, I'm saying, thank you for making me happy or healthy or satisfied. If something untoward happens to me, I am saying in the same way, please, thank you for letting me know that you exist. God exists everywhere, in every way, in every form. We have so many prayers in our religion, so many prayers. But sometimes the prayer is just like I pick up the phone and say, hello, I'm glad that you are there.
Steinsaltz said he would like to be remembered as a person who did something to make the world better. He also said he would like to live another 100 years, teaching, writing, doing what he can to repair the world, and to become, as he put it, the human being God possibly wants him to be. Next month, the first 4 volumes of the new Steinsaltz Talmud in English are due to come out. Finally, a memorial service at the Washington National Cathedral is planned for Charles Colson, the prominent evangelical leader who died last weekend after complications from a blood clot in his brain. He was 80 years old. A former Nixon aide who served time in prison for his involvement in the Watergate scandal, Colson famously became a born-again Christian. After his release, he founded Prison Fellowship, a ministry for prisoners and ex-prisoners. Colson was a frequent speaker and author and an outspoken advocate for religion in public life. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Find us on YouTube. Watch us anytime, anywhere on smartphones. There's also much more on our website. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from an interfaith worship service in Washington, D.C., where religious leaders marked Earth Day with calls for more government action on climate change.